Om. Welcome to our time of study of Bhagavad Gita. Each time that we come together, begin with a short prayer to gather our energy for study. And then I share teachings from Yogacharya O'Brien's past Gita studies, and then a few comments of my own and time allowing space for questions and comments. So let's begin with a moment of prayer. We acknowledge the radiant light of all truth. Knowing that we are an emanation of that radiance informs us that the wisdom of the divine is inherent to our own self, to our soul. So this wisdom of the Bhagavad Gita that has been shared through our lineage, through Lahiri Mahasaya, Swami Sri Teshwar, Paramahansa Yogananda, Roy Eugene Davis, and Yogacharya O'Brien Umaji. The same wisdom found in the Bhagavad Gita is accessible to us. So we give thanks to those who have written commentaries and shared the teachings of the Gita. And we open ourselves to our innate knowing. Let this wisdom be revealed in a practical manner. Let this change our lives. Let it uplift our family and community and be a beacon of hope in our world. Om, peace, peace, peace. So today we begin chapter 4. On the Gita, the yoga of renunciation, action, and knowledge. Lord Krishna continues to teach Arjuna the way of karma yoga, skillful action, and about jnana yoga, the way of wisdom. And in this chapter, it's combined with sannyasi yoga, which is the way of renunciation. And this chapter begins with Krishna's attempts to open his disciple Arjuna's mind to mystical insight. And it begins once again with the familiar confusion of Arjuna. So before we delve into this new chapter, let's take a moment to reflect on the themes of chapters 1, 2, and 3. So you remember chapter 1 is concerned with Arjuna's dilemma, his despondency about the great challenge that he faces going into battle against his own relatives. And then in chapter 2, Lord Krishna gives him a philosophical overview of the nature of reality. And he encourages him to rise up and face the challenge before him, armed with enlightened insight. And then in chapter 3, which is the chapter on karma yoga, we receive the teachings on how to act skillfully, how to engage with the world, in the world, that in a way that contributes to freedom, not bondage, to clarity, not confusion. This is where we left off. And because the Bhagavad Gita is a spiritual manual for how to live a spiritually awakened, conscious life, it's important that we gather our learnings along the way and see how we are changing as we study. This is the true spirit of svadhyaya, study and contemplation that brings insight and transformation. You know, what have we learned? What have we put into practice? And what have we experienced as a result? This is where the fruits of our contemplation are born. You know, not just by listening or reading and trying to understand, but looking at our own life. How have we digested this? And how is it expressing in and through us now? What has been the trajectory of the insights offered? So here's a short version. One, life presents challenges. Two, we have the spiritual insight and resources to meet those challenges. And three, we can learn how to see clearly, act wisely, and find freedom in the world. And now in chapter four, we further those insights as we begin to do a deep dive into the mystical insight about who Lord Krishna is. Who is the guru or the divine teacher? And what is the greater purpose for his presence beyond being Arjuna's war room advisor? Arjuna is about to learn something surprising about his teacher and about himself. So here are verses 1 through 4 of chapter 4. Listen to them carefully, and then for those of you who like to take notes, I suggest you go and read them later, because they're pretty deep. So you might want to just listen first. Number one, I'll read all four, then we'll go through them. Number one, the Blessed Lord spoke. I proclaimed this imperishable yoga to Vivasvat. Vivasvat communicated it to Manu, and Manu imparted it to Ishvaku. Number two, in this way, Arjuna, the supreme knowledge of yoga was passed down from one generation to the next by human kings who were both leaders and seers of Vedic knowledge. But over a long period of time, these yogic teachings were lost. Number three, that same ancient yoga has this day been taught to you, Arjuna, by me. For you are my devotee and my friend, and also because this is a supremely secret teaching. And another translation of verse 3. Therefore, today I am again transmitting that ancient body of yogic knowledge to you. Because you have chosen to hear from me in the mood of bhakti, devotion, and because you are my very dear friend, this secret teaching is from beyond the realms of matter. And then verse 4, Arjuna inquired, O Bhagavan Krishna, the deva of the sun, Vivasvan, came into being millions of years ago. How is it possible that you spoke this Vedic knowledge to him at that time? I warned you, these verses are quite interesting. So let's look at them, break them down, so to speak. Verse 1 and 2. The Blessed Lord Krishna spoke, I proclaimed this imperishable yoga to Vivasvat. Vivasvat communicated it to Manu, and Manu imparted it to Ishvaku. And two, in this way, Arjuna, the supreme knowledge of yoga was passed down from one generation to the next by human kings who were both leaders and seers of Vedic knowledge. But over a long period of time, these yogic teachings were lost. I'd pull my hair out, but
can't grab it.
So understanding verse number 1 of chapter 4 requires inquiry into the mystical code that is being offered. We can hear Lord Krishna proclaiming to have offered this teaching through the ages, but who is the I he refers to when he says, I proclaimed this imperishable yoga? And who are the recipients named as passing the teachings along through the generations? So in verse 1, Lord Krishna is speaking from the perspective of the eternal, illumined divine self, the I Am, which is beyond time. It's the same illumined consciousness Jesus spoke from when the scholars of his day questioned him in John chapter 8. They said to him, you are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. So a rishi, a seer of eternal truth, speaks from highest reality. That I proclaims the imperishable yoga through the ages, the truth of our being and the way to realize it. The way, the truth, the life. Just as many Christians interpret that I am statement made by Jesus to apply to him personally rather than to indicate a state of consciousness, so many Hindus also believe that the I am spoken by Lord Krishna signifies him only as the one supreme Lord. But mystics know there is one truth, one reality called by many names. And what can we know about those it was revealed to? So these verses require mystical insight. With mystical insight, we can understand that these legendary figures correspond to aspects of cosmic and individualized consciousness, and that they indicate the way in which supreme knowledge or the highest truth is revealed to humanity. So let's look at that. We're going to need an extra cup of coffee, aren't we, after this, or tea. Vivasvat is known as the sun god, which represents the light of supreme consciousness. It is the first objective manifestation from the transcendental field of absolute pure consciousness. Vivasvat is the first objective manifestation from the transcendental field of absolute pure consciousness. Is not a person. This light of supreme consciousness flows from the source, illumines the mental field, which is Manu. Remember, sharing it with Manu, Manas, which is cosmic mind and individualized mind, making possible illumined intuitive perception, which is Ishvaku. So these are words that are pointing to the manifestation process from the transcendental field of absolute pure consciousness. So this passage reveals the descent of supreme consciousness through the mind and the faculty of soul intuition in symbolic language. And from there, consciousness makes possible the egoic perspective, the sense of separate self, and the capacity of the senses. So just a side note, if you've been studying as we've gone along these past many months, the last several verses of chapter 3, you remember they were looking at working from the sense objects, the senses, working this direction. Now chapter 4 is working this direction. So this shows us that this highest knowledge of what we are is innate to our very being. It is supreme consciousness giving birth to itself. Tat svam asi. Thou art that. That thou art. You are that. That supreme consciousness. So yoga science is about understanding and realizing this cosmic manifestation process. The journey from consciousness into matter. And then understanding that our journey of awakening is following that same way back home, from the manifest realm of time and space to return to the eternal I am, the divine pure being, the unchanging consciousness of reality, the higher reality of our essence of being. Whew! I added that part. Whew! That's a lot to discern from that one passage. That's one passage. But as Umaji mentioned, and the commentators of this part of the Gita point to, these names are a kind of mystical code for the way in which supreme consciousness and its power bring forth manifestation. Consciousness is the eternal source of the teaching itself and can therefore be realized by us. There are two other important things to realize from this passage. First, that yoga is referred to as the supreme science. And it is declared as imperishable. It is imperishable or eternal because it is a revelation of the unchanging truth of life and of our very being. And we'll find out in the next verse how it could be possibly lost. So we also see in this verse pointing out the way of yoga, the way of spiritual awakening, through transmission of the teachings through the sages, from teacher to student or guru to disciple, as well as the esoteric level of the inner guru, the supreme self, that reveals it to the purified mind, to the receptive disciple. So we already have an example of the guru-disciple relationship between Krishna and Arjuna, and now we have the additional affirmation that this is the way that yoga has been taught from the beginning through all generations. It does not say that Vivasvat read it in a book and then posted a video on YouTube, and that's how Manu found out before he became a yoga teacher. So then verse 2, you know, how is it that this yoga referred to in verse 1 as being imperishable is then said to be lost? How can that which is imperishable be lost? It takes a lot of contemplation to deeply understand these verses. This is why, you know, when we study, we're taught to meditate deeply first, like we do. Meditate deeply first, then read a verse. Don't read the commentary. Contemplate it. Then from the depths of your intuitive wisdom, see what is revealed. Then you can read a commentary. But ask yourself first. So verse 2 says, in this way, Arjuna, the supreme knowledge of yoga was passed down from one generation to the next by human kings who were both leaders and seers of Vedic knowledge. But over a long period of time, these yogic teachings were lost. So the teachings themselves have been declared as imperishable. They are indestructible and enduring. Yet here we're told that they're lost. They have not lost their potency, their essence, or their relevancy. It is the capacity of people to value or perceive them that becomes lost. The teachings are the same. The understanding of them has been lost. We can see this in our own lives. And when Umiji wrote Living the Eternal Way, her introductory text to yoga, she offered a short version of these essential teachings in sutra form, and most of you know them. The first sutra says, it is. There's one reality that is both transcendent and immanent, beyond and within the manifest realm. It is supreme consciousness with its power expressing as all that is. That's number one, it is. Number two, of course, then, we are it. Because there is only one reality, it is expressing as each one of us. We cannot be separate from it. Therefore, we are destined to awaken to that truth of our being. And then, you know, the third sutra we refer to as wah, wah, wah. We forget. We forget. Until we become established in the realization of our essential nature, we may hear the truth, recognize it, and even understand it. But due to our involvement with the body, mind, and circumstances, we forget our true nature. That is the cause of suffering. And then the fourth sutra is the good news, which is we remember. This is the goal of yoga, to be established in self and God realization, or what could be called divine knowledge or divine remembrance. So it's not that yoga itself was lost, because the truth endures. It is imperishable. But we forget on an individualized and global level. And that forgetfulness always brings suffering. But that sorrow also brings forth a response from divine grace. And that will be addressed in the upcoming verses. So one other thing to notice about this verse, number two, is how on the historical level, the individuals who are indicated as recipients of these teachings through the generations are awakened householders. They are enlightened people in the world with roles and responsibilities. Knowers of truth, active in the world. Okay, let's move on to verse 3. I'll share two translations again, and then just a little bit of information. Verse 3. That same ancient yoga has this day been taught to you, Arjuna, by me. For you are my devotee and my friend, and also because this is a supreme secret. Here's another translation. Therefore, today I am again transmitting that ancient body of yogic knowledge to you, because you have chosen to hear from me in the mood of bhakti, devotion, and because you are my very dear friend. This secret teaching is also from beyond the realms of matter. Verse 3 is beautiful because it addresses our intimacy with God. It indicates how illumination and inspiration flow from source into the receptive heart and mind. The friend, the divine friend, tells the dear friend, the one who is near, close, the one who is listening. On the outer level as well, the teacher responds to the receptive student. You know, the teaching goes like this. I am teaching you this. I am offering this to you because this is the way. It is subtle. It is hidden from sense perception and from thinking mind. It is beyond the realms of matter. It is the highest truth, Krishna is saying to Arjuna, the truth of your own being. You must experience it. You cannot know it with your mind alone. You may understand the words, but knowledge must come through transmission, through your direct experience. Okay then, says Arjuna. Okay then, how does that work? Aren't you my cousin, Krishna? And didn't you come just to help me figure out how to deal with this battle I'm facing? What is this about? You teaching even those who were here before you. What? And then verse 4 says this question. Arjuna inquired, O Bhagavan, Krishna, O Bhagavan, the Deva of the sun, Vivasvan, came into being millions of years ago. How is it possible that you spoke this Vedic knowledge to him at that time? This is Arjuna saying, help me to see clearly the way that things are. Wow, wow, wow. So I have a short amount of comments focused on verse 3 of chapter 4. which I call the secret of ancient yoga. Here's a different translation. That same ancient yoga has this day been taught to you by me, Krishna to Arjuna. For you are my devotee and my friend, and also because this is a supreme secret. So this verse comes from a moment where Krishna is reawakening Arjuna's remembrance of what is eternal. The timeless teaching of yoga that brings us into direct experience of the highest self. He's saying, wake up. Krishna says, I have given you this ancient yoga today because you are my devotee and my friend. It's a profoundly personal statement, isn't it? Can you feel that? He doesn't say, because you are a scholar, or because you have perfected meditation. He doesn't say that. He says, but because there is love, bhakti, because there is love and friendship. And these are the inner qualities that open the channel through which divine wisdom knows. We can have intellectual knowing. That's different than divine wisdom. And Krishna calls this teaching a secret, as Umaji said also, not because it's hidden from us, but because it is revealed only in the stillness of a receptive heart. The secret is not theoretical, it's experiential. It's known when the mind and the life force, prana, are inwardly harmonized, when prana is interiorized, returns to the source, and then consciousness rests in the true self. There are no external distractions. Raging Davis wrote in The Science of Self-Realization, the truth is not concealed from us. It is concealed by our restless thoughts. The truth is not concealed from us. It is concealed by our restless thoughts. So when we quiet the mental waves through superconscious meditation, the ancient yoga that Krishna is speaking of is rediscovered within us. It's not some new revelation that is being made up, but it's a reawakening of the soul's innate knowing. You know, it's like there's, let's just say we are one matchstick in a box of matches. And here comes Krishna, you know, with his candle lit, lighting things up. If this match is lifted to that light, what it already is, the potential for luminosity is awakened. But if there are winds of distraction around, it can't be lit up. It's pretty simple. The words, you are my devotee and my friend, point us to the sacred mystery of the guru-disciple relationship. This relationship is both intimate and transcendent. Intimate and personal are different. This relationship is not personal. It's not ego-based. It's not about personality. It's intimate, the soul level, and transcendent. The guru does not stand above the disciple, but beside the disciple, as Krishna does with Arjuna. The guru stands beside the disciple, offering a divine companion on the path of realization. If we have an experience of the guru being above us, like pointing down, do this, do that, we are the one who created that. You know, in Kriya Yoga, we understand that the guru is not some personality to be worshipped, but a representation of the living presence of divine consciousness that awakens through a relationship of trust, of love, and of surrender. These are the ingredients for that relationship, or any relationship, to function at the highest level, right? Trust must be there, love must be there, and surrender if we are to receive anything. In Umaji's book, Living for the Sake of the Soul, she wrote, "When the guru appears, it is the self, the higher self, it is the self revealing itself to itself." When the guru appears, it is the self revealing itself to itself. And Krishna calls Arjuna a friend because true discipleship ripens into divine friendship. A relationship of equality in spirit. It's a soul relationship. And when this ripening occurs, the disciple no longer feels separate from the teacher, but begins to see through the eyes, the same eyes of wisdom. This is the experience of attunement, seeing through the same eyes of wisdom. And this is why Paramahansa Yogananda said, the guru is the awakened God, beckoning the sleeping God and the disciple to wake up. In the second coming of Christ, he wrote, the guru is the awakened God, beckoning the sleeping God and the disciple to wake up. Hey, come on, let's go play. Get out of bed, get your tennis shoes on. The sun has come out, the snow has melted off the driveway, let's go shoot some hoops. Wake up. When we approach these teachings with that kind of reverence and openness, the transmission is direct. You know, the same living current of grace that flowed from Krishna to Arjuna, from Lahiri Mahashaya to Sri Yukteswar to Paramahansa Yogananda, from Yogananda to Roy Eugene Davis, to Yogacharya O'Brien, and from Umaji to us, that same current flows now, whenever the heart is ready, whenever we are surrendered, receptive. So in our modern lives, this secret is not hidden in some cave or some distant ashram. And it's nice to go visit the caves of St. Francis, right? His disciples. It's nice to go to an ashram in the Himalayas in India, but this supreme secret is not hidden there. I remember when I first wanted to go to India, you know, gosh, 25 years ago, I guess, and I had this fantasy of, oh, I'm going to go to India and I'm going to just meditate so deeply. It's going to be so great and quiet. I was talking with Umaji about going and she just started laughing. And she said, Sundari, if you want a quiet place to meditate, stay here. India is not quiet. Of course, there are quiet places in India, but boy, was she right. This supreme secret is not hidden in some ancient cave or distant ashram. It's hidden in plain sight. It's hidden in our own distracted attention. And the way to find it is to bring our awareness home again and again and again to the divine source of life within us. So when we begin each day with superconscious meditation, remembering that divine friendship, I mean, that's what we're doing, right? Think of it that way. Maybe it'll give a refresh in your meditation, you know, because it can become rote. Think of it as, oh, I'm going to go sit with my divine friend. I'm going to dress for it. I'm going to sit up nice and relaxed, but attentive for it. I'm going to open myself intentionally with receptivity to experience that friendship. When we connect with that each day in superconscious meditation, remembering that divine friendship, that living link with the guru and with the divine, we are restoring the ancient yoga, the secret within ourselves. When we act with devotion, you know, when we offer our work, our seva, our service, our relationships, when we offer those consciously, we become beacons of that same timeless light. So we embrace it and we offer it with the way that we live. So this teaching is ancient, but it's also immediate. Krishna says, this day I have taught you this yoga. So each moment of clarity, each breath, conscious breath, is a new this day. Each time we turn our consciousness within, that is this day I have taught you this yoga. So the key to receiving this teaching as Arjuna is, have humility as a disciple, as a learner. Have openness as a friend. And have the courage to live in the light of this supreme secret that dwells within us. So have humility, have openness, and have courage to let this divine light flow brilliantly through us. Om. That's my list of three. You know I like lists. Humility, openness, and courage. Holy cow. These are something, aren't they? These verses? Questions, comments, as Uma sometimes says, confessions, but keep them surface level only. These verses are a mouthful. I think these verses, the way that Umaji unraveled them for us, provide a very good reminder about the importance of studying scripture, the Gita, deeply. Right? Because sometimes we can just read it and go, well, that doesn't make much sense to me, but I better go on to the next verse because here we are. So it's a good reminder that when we come to those verses with all those names, look up the names. See what they mean symbolically. What is the symbolic meaning of this name, this name, this name? You know, if you like to study Samkhya, ask, how do they relate to Samkhya? How do they relate to Kriya Yoga? How do they relate to meditation? Right? Do you sometimes do that? Read a verse like this one and just go, oh. Azumo sometimes says, oy vey. Oy Veda.
Oy Veda.
Oy Veda. Hi, Mukti Devi.
Thank you. Thank you so much again for these teachings. I've been contemplating on my own some the connection between we're here for a purpose. We have a dharma, our own divine purpose. And it seems to me that when we say we forget because of the involvement in our mind, our body, and the circumstances, that those circumstances somehow are also involved with creating circumstances such that we may accomplish or provide or fulfill our purpose in life. But that's just my own musings of, I think it's part and parcel of why do we suffer, you know, but it's there's purpose in our being here, and yet somehow we forget in the process of being here exactly who and what we are, and yet our supreme dharma is to remember and also to bring joy to whatever our purpose is in life. I'm not sure that I have a question, but I wondered if you can help guide me in how I can think about this in a useful way. Or am I off track?
Yes, yes. When we are fulfilling our dharma, our divine destiny, it is an actual experience and expression of the radiant source of life flowing through us uninhibited. Mm-hmm. And so it is not part of any distraction. It is simply a clear expression of our essence of being. So fulfilling our dharma is an experiential, I'll say, example or expression of complete remembrance.
Yes.
Of this secret knowledge. So I think that might be what you were trying to say. I'm not sure, but
it is. I think that what my real question or issue is, I'm looking for, I want to believe that there is a purpose in the suffering and the forgetfulness that will help me, that is required almost in order to come to the remembrance and fulfillment of Dharma. I'm wanting to see that whatever things are causing pain have a reason.
I understand. And you all know, and you know how the Bhagavad Gita works. We have a question, and the next verse answers it.
Okay.
So the upcoming verses actually address how God, how the divine, calls us to itself when we go into a state of sorrow. Suffering. So you are making a perfect segue to the upcoming verses.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll wait. Thank
yeah.
you.
Isn't that great how it works?
Yes.
how it
Thank
works.
You.
And And it is a very high calling to remain anchored in our true self and committed to our dharma, which is to living our highest innate soul quality, joy, love, whatever that is that you know it is, in the face of the suffering in front of us. So I'm talking to you.
I hear you.
In the face of all of that, to remain anchored to the truth of who and what we know we are. Joy, love. Now that doesn't mean if we're in a situation, let's say there's been a great loss in our family, or we're supporting someone with illness, it doesn't mean that if our innate soul quality that we most highly relate to is joy, that we show up like la-di-da, right? That would be disrespectful, right? However, inside of us, we remain anchored even as we are being a compassionate presence in the face of what the suffering in our own life, our family, our community, our nation, our world. But when it's intimate, when it's our own family, it really, boom, hits us, right?
Yes.
Even in the face of that, we remain anchored in the knowing that our soul is an expression of joy. I have this picture in my meditation chapel at home of Baba Hari Das offering ashes into the Ganges. And they are the ashes of one of his dearest longtime disciples, Ma Renu. And he looks complete. When she made her transition, it was a huge loss in Mount Madonna community. She was a pillar in that community. And in that picture, while he is in the face, and he was very close with her, very, very close, so it was a loss. In that picture, you can see the contentment of his heart in the midst of releasing that great soul consciously. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
So you can see, I love that picture, someone gave it to me. I love that picture because it always reminds me of this, to remain anchored in the truth of who and what I am, regardless of the circumstances around me. That doesn't mean we're not sad. It doesn't mean we don't have pain. It doesn't mean we don't have sorrow. Those are part of being in a human experience. We have those experiences, we don't let them have us. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, you're walking a very high line right now. You're doing it beautifully.
Thank you.
Yeah, just stay anchored in your divine knowing of your true essence, and don't let your mind, because you're such an intellect, start trying to figure out why it's happening. Just
okay.
Be present with it. Don't miss the precious opportunity of being the beacon of light that you are in the presence of what is going on in your life. Don't miss the opportunity by letting your mind get distracted about thinking about why is this happening.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
It's like a mother giving birth and saying, why does this, I've never given birth, so I'm making this up. But I'm thinking, you know, it's painful, I understand. But instead of appreciating the joy and blessing of the new baby, just being like, why does this hurt so much? Why does this hurt so much? Why does this hurt so much?
I think that's a beautiful, beautiful metaphor. Thank you.
Yeah, instead just embrace the beauty of the experience, because, you know, coming and going are both part of all of it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, that was a long answer, but I'm looking at many of you and I'm trying to weave in things that I know or think I know about what's going on in your life. Hi, Sakshi. Have you withstood the rains?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
They're loud.
Yeah, I've been watching you up there.
Just kind of floating through.
Yeah, you and Laurel, and then Saraswati's getting a tip of it.
Excuse me. I have no questions. It was beautiful.
It's so nice to see you.
Thank you. I got it.
You are just, it.
Yes, I am. My pronoun is soham.